يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to our latest Middle East Analysis podcast. Now, there's been some humongously large news in the meantime, and that was the resignation of the Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, taking effect on the 28th of February 2013 at 8 p.m. Now, being Middle East Analysis, I am joined by the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, who is also an international lawyer, ecumenical and political expert on the region. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you?
I'm fine, James. It is quite a gripping story and one that pretty much came out of the blue.
Now, since the Pope's resignation, you've done a great many interviews across secular channels, mainly, in fact, covering an awful lot of ground. So today we're going to be talking about Pope Benedict XVI, his relationship with the region, if you like. And Harry, I'd just like to start by saying, well, you know, from his pontificate, April 2005, we had Regensburg, the Regensburg Address a year later, a slightly up and down relationship with Islam. We've had the Holy Father in the Blue Mosque in Turkey,
and Istanbul,
and the Muslim Scholar's Letter, of course, in the wake of that. There's so many things to talk about. I'm going to throw it over to you to start us off. Where would you start with the pontificate and the Holy Father's relationship with the Middle East and North Africa?
Well, perhaps, James, before starting on the Pope's relationship with the Middle East North Africa, let me quibble with you on a term that everybody is using across the board, whether religious media or the secular media. And I'm being a bit mischievous here because it's a term that is perfectly acceptable. However, I find it a little bit bizarre that people are talking about resignation. Now, it is true that according to canon law, he has the right to resign so long as it is done in full freedom. In other words, that he has all his mental capacities and he's aware of what he's doing, which clearly in the case of Benedict XVI, it is the case. But instead of calling it resignation, what I've been calling it in my interviews here and there is retirement. Because the question is, he's resigning from the papacy. But to whom is he submitting his resignation when he's the head of the church? The only person he can submit it to is God. So in that sense, I don't look at it as a resignation. I look at it as a man who will be 86 in a couple of months' time and who has decided that his physical and mental faculties are tired and he wants to go and cloister himself into a convent and read and write. In that sense, I would call it retirement. But that is me just being mischievous and quibbling with you on terms. So whether it's resignation or retirement, let me say that the Pope has had quite an impact on the Middle East, North Africa for two reasons. One, the impact has been in relation to the local indigenous Christian communities. Our listeners by now, after so many podcasts on the MENA, have come to realize that there are quite a number of different Christians, largely Arab, in this part of the world. They hail from the Orthodox Church, from the Catholic Church, or from the Reformed churches. And therefore, there has been a relationship there, perhaps an organic one with the Catholic churches and a less organic one with the other Christian churches. So that's one thing that the Pope has had to deal with. Those churches, Christianity in the MENA region, incidentally, in the midst of uprisings at the moment, where the whole future of the region is being questioned, including the future of the Christian communities themselves. Then you have, of course, relationship with Islam, and largely the region is Muslim, predominantly Sunni, but also Shi'i. And then you have Israel, the state of Israel, and the relationship with Judaism. So if you put all this together, that in itself would keep or should keep a person busy, and yet it is only one part of what the Pope, as the priest of priests, has done across the whole region. So in a sense, I would subdivide it into three categories: relations with Christians and with the Christian church in the MENA region, with Islam, and with Judaism. And in all three, perhaps more so in the second and third instances, there have been ups and downs. There have been highlights and there have also been downlights, if I can coin a word. And in that sense, it would be very interesting how history would see Pope Benedict XVI's legacy, because it is always foolhardy, in my opinion, to come out with very brash and quick conclusions as to whether it was a wonderful papacy or not such a wonderful papacy, particularly after when he comes after somebody who was so charismatic, almost a star performer, and then we have this diffident man, this private man, this German who takes over and tries to steer the church in a certain direction and tries to give himself a name which shows his relationship with Europe more than anything else. And yet, Europe really and the West are the key areas where we can see lots of fallibilities in the faith as we understand it.
I love it. You redefine the dictionary pretty much every time you do a podcast. Fantastic. What was that? Downlights. Brilliant.
You see, as an Armenian, I can get away with it. English is not my first language, so I can coin words.
What's my excuse? I don't have one. Let's start by looking at those Abrahamic faiths that, mm-hmm. that you've drawn reference to. Now, clearly, it was something of a shaky start with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Also, from the very, very start, he made it quite clear about how he wanted to strengthen the relationship with the Orthodox churches. Mm-hmm. I think that's a key part of the pontificate in many ways.
I agree.
And we will go on to Judaism, of mm-hmm. course. But let's start with Islam. Tough start for him, but quite a lot of respect thereafter, I would say, would you not?
You know, it's very interesting because every cloud has a silver lining, and in a sense, and the silver lining of the Regensburg University address, where the Pope quoted a 14th century Byzantine emperor who was basically saying that everything that is wrong with the world is due to Islam, that in a sense, I think was a naive error. And it was an error of judgment that should have been stopped before he actually took that piece of paper in his hand and read it. Somebody should have realized that this is not what needs to be said or can be said or is necessarily the whole picture of what Islam is within that region. Yet, of course, once he'd said it, and he said it as an academic, at the end of the day, he's a professor. He's been to so many German universities before he became prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith in Rome with John Paul II. And in all those universities, if you follow his trajectory, Benedict XVI, at the time Josef Ratzinger, was very much a progressive. He was somebody who was viewed as very pro-Vatican II, very much taking the church to the edge. And then in the 1960s, with the riots in the States and the riots in Europe, suddenly this man seems to have thought that the orthodoxy of Catholicism is being frayed. And in that sense, he became, in a sense, more conservative and traditional in his views. So in that sense, I would suspect that that Regensburg address as an academic at the beginning of his papacy, of his pontificacy, was pretty much a naive move to make. But the interesting thing is that after all the brouhaha and the hullabaloo and the reactions, some of them quite legitimate, because if somebody attacks my faith in that sense, I would also have something to say about it. However, what that did is it led to a more sustained dialogue with Islam. He tried to basically show goodwill and good faith as well. You mentioned in your intro the visit to the Blue Mosque in Turkey. He also met with many, many Muslim scholars. There were dialogical exercises between the Roman Catholic Church and the Muslim world. Not forgetting, again, and this is an important factor, that there are Arab Christians in the region. And in a sense, those Arab Christians are the bridge between Rome and Catholicism as a Western entity and the MENA region. So all this led, I think, gradually to an acceptance that that was a hasty remark, but it was not the whole story. It was part of the story, because our history as Christians has at times been violent, as has been that of Islam. And incidentally, if you look at the Old Testament, as it has been with Judaism as well. But that's never the whole story. The whole story is much bigger than that.
Now, I'm going to chance my arm a bit here, because I know you were involved at the turn of the millennium when it came to Pope John Paul II's visit to the MENA region.
You've got a good memory.
Now, just tell me how the two men differ in your mind, in their approach and, again, their relationship to the region.
You know, it's very interesting. You talked about interviews. I'm in the process of writing quite a comprehensive article on my thoughts about Benedict XVI, where he was and where the church will probably go in the future. And in a sense, I think personally that John Paul II and Benedict XVI were not miles apart in terms of their doctrinal approach to our faith, in terms of their wish as to where the church would go. Both of them were worried about the secularism that is basically praying into the church and invading some of its corridors. But both of them were doing it in different ways. John Paul II was the missionary. He spent half his time on planes. I mean, he's the equivalent of Hillary Rodham Clinton because he was never off a plane, going here, going there. I remember so much his visits personally to the Middle East, to the Ukraine, to Paris, elsewhere, where not only just ordinary Catholics, but young Catholics, as well as other Christians, as well as Muslims, would line up the streets and welcome him. Here was the star who could actually perform as if he was basically starring in an Oscar film. Benedict XVI was the more scholarly, introverted, intellectual pope. But both of them had the same idea, how to, I wouldn't say firewall the church, but how to protect the church from the invasive, intrusive nature of secularism as it keeps picking on the fundamentals of faith. And I believe that's what they did in their own different ways. John Paul II probably pulled it off better. Maybe that's what history would show, because he had this outgoing nature. Benedict XVI at times looked very uncomfortable with himself in public, although when you spoke with him in private, he was a very charming and a very intelligent interlocutor.
Let's talk about the other faiths. What about Pope Benedict's relationship with the Jews and with Judaism?
Well, there again, it was a seesawing experience with Judaism. I think it had its good moments and it had its bad moments. One of the most critical and negative moments of his papacy was when he rehabilitated Bishop Williamson. And Bishop Williamson, if anybody had done his homework at the Vatican, they would have known that he's a Holocaust denier, and they wouldn't have touched that with a barge pole. But here was Benedict XVI trying to bring in one faction of the church back into the main body. And by basically rehabilitating or giving credence to this bishop, basically Holocaust denier. There was also another Regensburg moment, but this time not touching the Muslims, touching the Jews. However, since then, his statements, his comments, his visits to the mosque in Rome, his visit to Yad Vashem when he visited the Holy Land, all this has shown his willingness to go the extra mile in order to show by actions, by words and deeds about his complete rejection of the Nazi Holocaust. And remember, he's a German, so it's a very sensitive area. If he weren't German, it wouldn't have stuck so much as it did, because he is a German with a Bavarian past when he was a young teenager. So in that sense, he tried to do his best. And I believe that two things happened since then that made the relationship better. One is his own proactive approach to Judaism. Secondly, I think when he came to this country, to the UK, I thought it was remarkable that the person who welcomed him in the name of all the other faiths was the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks. And Jonathan Sacks did an interview in which he said that until that day, he was a little bit doubtful about exactly where Benedict XVI was coming from. when they had that little interaction, he was so impressed by the man, again, my distinction between the public and the private, that he then made an effort to seek an audience, go to Rome, and further that friendship with the Pope. So in a sense, there again, ups and downs, gaffes, let's call it gaffes. I have no problem calling it gaffes, but some of them have been remedied, and so highs and lows with Islam and Judaism. But I think more critical for me is his relationship with the Christian churches, particularly in the MENA region.
Well, let's talk about that. And, you know, in recent memory, after the Synod of Bishops the previous year on the Middle East, mm-hmm. the Pope actually travelled to Lebanon be amongst the Maronite Christians as well, and to release, here comes the mouthful, the post-synodal apostolic exhortation on the Middle East. You mentioned yourself the visit to the Holy Land, something of an echo of John Paul II's. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that relationship, because he was amongst the Arab Christians of the region.
He was amongst the Arab Christians of the region. And let me just qualify one thing you said. I know what you meant, but let us qualify it nonetheless. He was not only amongst the Maronites. The geography of the visit was Lebanon, where the Maronite church has its base in Ibkirke in Beirut. But the visit was, as you said, the mouthful, in order to submit that apostolic exhortation or that roadmap. Basically, that's what it is. It's a document which is a roadmap that came out of the synod that took place in Rome in 2010. And remember, the visit was 2012, so it took 2 years to think about this roadmap. What does the church in the Middle East, North Africa need to do in order to forward its ministry and its witness, let alone its presence in the midst of all the uprisings and the emigration? He came there to meet all the Catholic Church leaders of the whole region. So whether it's Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, everywhere, they came together, they met, and the idea was, on the one hand, to talk about what is the roadmap for the Christians ahead, because there are also weaknesses within the church in the Arab world, in the MENA region as well. It's a small community bedeviled with many problems. But for me, the visit didn't stop with that famous document. That visit had a higher purpose. And I think that higher purpose was to try and bring a closeness between Arab Christians and Arab Muslims in the region. And a lot of the time that the Pope spent in Lebanon with all those church leaders, and then of course he met the Orthodox church leaders and other leaders. And for me, James, it's very important to note this point. Whether you take the Ravenna Declaration, whether you take the various meetings that the Pope had with the Oriental or Eastern Orthodox churches, I personally think that his sense of ecumenism, his definition of ecumenism, was at its sharpest and at its highest in his relations with the Orthodox members of the Christian faith. Let's not forget that. That's one of the traditions and legacies that I'm quite willing to defend, although there are others that I simply cannot. But when he came and talked to those Christians in Beirut, he also talked to the Muslims, the Muslim leadership from the Sunni, the Shi'i, and the Druze traditions, and in so doing, tried to heal some of the wounds that, whether it's Islamism, whether it's the uprisings, whether it's the fear, whether it's the concern of the region about where it's heading, and to try and make sure that the Christians play a role in that region as peacemakers, as reconcilers, as bridge builders, and not only as people who are there panting and heaving and gasping and not knowing what to do or packing their bags and running away.
I'm going to give you the final thought, Harry, but maybe within that final thought, how would you sum up Pope Benedict XVI's legacy with regard to the region?
A man of contradictions, a man of paradoxes, a man with great intellect and a very strong, unflinching faith, but a man, in my opinion, who was a leader of the 20th century. My hope, given the challenges that we face in the 21st century, and given the work that he has done and the foundations that he has laid, both him and his predecessor, John Paul II, that the conclave of cardinals, when they meet, that they will elect a successor who will take on the good work, labor in the vineyard of the Lord, as we say, and do it in such a way as the church manages to meet up the challenges it faces, both internally and externally, whether in Rome or across the world.
Very well put, Harry. Now, I should drop in a few bits and pieces now. That is that the home of Middle East Analysis is on catholicnews.org.uk. And for those of you that might be wanting to check Harry out on Twitter, check out at Harry Hagopian. Relatively new to it, but you'll soon see the gusto and enthusiasm that Harry has thrown into
it's
Twitter.
It's a rudderless gusto and enthusiasm, James, and it's pointedly rudderless. I'm not doing anything with a clever ploy or scheme. I'm just having fun with Twitter, putting there whatever suits my mind, and people might like it or dislike it. But can I be rude and intrude with two little anecdotal points,
please,
which
do.
I thought would lift up a little bit this whole discussion about Pope Benedict XVI. The first one is, of course, everybody now is in the business of trying to decide who's going to be the next pope. Italian, African, Latin American, Filipino, what? Interestingly enough, if you go on the Facebook pages of many, many of the MENA region people, there is now a movement to make the Maronite Patriarch of Beirut, Cardinal Bishara El-Rai, as the next pope. Of course, it's not going to happen. And if it happens, I'll come and eat my scarf next time we have another podcast, because I'm not wearing a hat, so this is all I can eat. But having said that, it's very interesting because it shows a commitment by the Middle Eastern Christians to their faith and to the hope that they continue to play a part in the evolving nature of that faith, in the renewing nature of that faith, not in the stultifying, pedantic nature of that faith. We should invigorate the faith. We should not just sit on it and be happy with what we've done, because the faith will die. So that is one anecdote. The second anecdote, which I think is hilarious, if you go on the internet, as I'm sure you did because you're so much better at it than I, there's a craze now about the Pope and his hats, whether the red hat, whether the big sombrero hat, whether all those hats that he wore. And I think it's wonderful, because at the end of the day, this is the man, that is the office, and we can separate them together and then bring them together again.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much. That's it for today's Middle East Analysis. Again, check us out on catholicnews.org.uk, Twitter @CatholicEW, and we'll be back with another Middle East Analysis very shortly.